So this afternoon, I'm going to talk much further and much more in depth on the not just the practice of mindfulness, but really the teachings of mindfulness. We've talked about it quite a bit, and at this point in the retreat, it can be helpful to really understand the depth of what this practice really means, and really looking at what's called the Satipatthana. The Satipatthana Sutta. Sutta just means sort of teaching. The Satipatthana is really where all of the mindfulness teachings come from. And in really in a few short pages, the Buddha really talks about how to navigate the human system in a way that's insanely thorough and unbelievably accurate. And still to this day, kind of gives me chills to imagine what this man was like in all these many thousands of years ago, that he was actually able to describe the human experience in precise detail by just watching. No device, no AI, no machine, just sitting under a tree, watching, remembering, recollecting, and then being able to articulate in really precise detail what the moment-by-moment experience of living in this organism is like. But before I get into that, I just want to take a moment to reflect on the kind of cultural reality of the power and the importance of this practice in the world that we live right now, as much as we're doing our best to stay away from that. I think it's important to reflect and just really have a deep sense of gratitude that we actually get to practice in this way, in this context. So a couple questions is, why is mindfulness so popular? You know, 10 years ago, the cover of Time magazine, The Mindfulness Revolution, that was like 12 years ago now, 10 years ago. So it's, you know, you can't go into a health food store in America without finding a mindfulness magazine somewhere on the rack. Why is that? And what is it about the modern world? Why is it that people are really just very unhappy? I mean, we seemingly have a lot of advancements in food and medicine and entertainment. The advancements we've made and the pleasure that we have access to. Seemingly, this is like the best time to be alive, right? From a kind of materialistic point of view, people are totally unhappy. And then the question I like to ask myself is, are these two connected? Is the popularity of mindfulness connected to the fact that people are so deeply unhappy? And I think that it is. And there's really kind of three things that I think encapsulate this in a really meaningful way and really kind of in a poignant way. And one is just the radical sadness that arises for me when I think about the mental health crisis that most people are facing. Just this deep sense of unhappiness, disconnection, addiction, suicide. It's really a hard time for a lot of people right now. And on a more positive note, perhaps, there is also this tremendous interest and this long-standing conversation going on for maybe 25, 30 years now between cognitive science and Buddhism. And, you know, we have cognitive science, we have neuroscience, I would even include clinical and therapeutic sciences, the way that we, from a Western point of view, from a Western modern point of view, the way that we understand human suffering and happiness and the body and trauma, and that school of thinking is having a long-standing conversation with Buddhism to see that there's a lot of connections to be made into the fact that, you know, I think the Buddha was right about a lot of stuff. You know, and to me that's just actually, I'm fascinated by this. I think about this stuff endlessly. And so then when we look at the teachings, this word, this practice of mindfulness. So just to kind of give us some background, it does come from this text called the Satipatthana, which is, if you look at the Pali Canon, which I don't necessarily recommend that you do, because it is a gigantic volume of repetitive texts that are totally and completely unorganized. So it's not light reading material. However, this particular text is one of the most highly organized texts in all of the suttas. It's very, very organized. It's very, very sophisticated. It has a definition. It has a reframe. It's really, really well crafted, which is also to say that it has probably been worked over many, many times by the tradition. And certainly in the Insight tradition, which is kind of what we're practicing here, or even more specifically, maybe the Theravada tradition, it's sort of the coveted text. Many books have been around. There's a Chris referenced him yesterday a few times. Bhikkhu Anāyā, who's written like 3 books on the Satipatthana now. Joseph Goldstein's most recent book, Mindfulness, 500 pages or so, is on the Satipatthana. And if you dare to listen, if you go to Dharma Seed, there's Joseph Goldstein has 51 one-hour talks on the Satipatthana Sutta. You know, and the Satipatthana Sutta is like 12 pages printed out. So just the depth of material that we're talking about is really quite fascinating. So what does this word actually mean? It's a compound word. The word mindfulness actually doesn't really do a great job to describe the complexity of what this word satipatthana means. Sati, the word, is correlated to the English word to remember, but not as in so much memory, like my memories of the past, but memory itself and the function of mind that allows us to remember or to recall. A lot of words that have the prefix re, recall, remember, reflect. It's about kind of bringing to mind, calling to mind. In some teachings, it says bringing to mind, calling to mind that which was said and done long ago. Remembering the Dharma, really. Remembering these teachings. Remember to recognize, there's another R-E word. Remember to recognize the present moment experience. Remember to recognize how valuable this life is. Remember to recognize that we are here now. It shows up, the first place it shows up, actually, which I find to be quite beautiful, Chris read it last night, the Metta Sutta, which Chris read last night. The teachings of Metta, which are actually in a section of the Pali Canon that is one of the oldest section, which is called the Sutta Nipata. And all of the teachings in the Sutta Nipata read like poetry. And it's actually the first place in the Pali Canon where the word sati appears. And it says one must maintain this reflection, is the word Chris used yesterday, but to maintain this recollection, satim sati, may all beings be at ease. So all of the teachings of the Brahma Viharas are actually mindfulness practices. Remember, may all beings be at ease, may all beings be okay. This like remembering to well wish. You know. So there's this tremendous, for lack of a better word, ethical dimension to the practice of mindfulness, to the teachings of mindfulness. It's not just about kind of paying attention and watching, which is in many ways how it's been boiled down. It's really this deep, rich way where we're just remembering our humanity, we're remembering what's important, we're remembering our sense of values. We're remembering a lot of things that actually we forget a lot, don't we? Because we get caught up, we get distracted, we get yanked around by so many things to do. And then we come on a retreat like this and we start to recollect, oh yeah, like I do want to be nicer to myself. I do have this fragile heart. I do have this part of my humanity that needs to be recovered, needs to be remembered, needs to be brought into this experience. So this word sati is, to translate it as mind, is like, it just doesn't even begin to do the heavy lifting. The second half of the word, so satipatthana tana, which gets translated as foundation, which is quite good. Tana means a ground or a foundation. It also means to stand near, to place near, to place the mind near. Right? And so these tanas, and I'll talk about them, There's four of them, these four tanas, the body, the feelings, the mental states, and the ideation aspect of the mind is really what these grounds and foundations are. One of the ways that Joseph Goldstein talks about them, which I think to be really helpful, is that, you know, this idea that all four of these foundations are actually happening all the time. In many ways, the Satipatthana Sutta is kind of like a diagnostic manual to understand the equipment, right, that we are born in, and how the equipment functions and how the equipment is interrelated. And so they're kind of understood as there are these pastures of awareness. There are these like pastures that we can be more aware, we can be more attuned to the sense of the body. Or I would actually prefer to use the word the somatic experience, because it gives us a broader sense. It's not just the body. It's the body, it's the nervous system, it's the respiratory system, it's the organs. It's not just the body, it's a lot going on in the body that we totally don't attend to. Right? So we can kind of be, we can put our attention in this pasture of our experience, which is embodied, which is kind of what you've been doing. We've been encouraging you to do that. We also can bring awareness into the feeling capacity, the affective experience, that, you know, everything affects us. We are, like it or not, we are insanely sensitive creatures. You know, we're pretty good at shutting it down, but the truth of the matter is we are just like vulnerable. And then we have this then we get into the mentality, the mental states, the attitude of the mind. And then we have this fourth foundation, which is kind of ideation or thought creation or construction of ideas and concepts in a world. And that's probably where most people live, right, up here. Thinking too much about everything all the time. Right? And then we can kind of become like, you know, like a head without a body. Right? And so we have to remember that we have a body. Other than just like stubbing your toe in the middle of the night, then you always remember you have a body. And then you get angry, I'm going to chop my toe off, it hurts so bad. Right? So we do. We actually, as you can see, I hopefully can see, is that we really do have to train ourselves. And this is what the Buddha is offering you. This is a training manual for how we can be more embodied and how we can be more in touch with the fullness. There's that word mindfulness. The fullness of our experience. Because there's different information in different aspects of these, of the body. The body has different information than the mind does. The feeling system has different information. And so a lot of times we ignore important information. And then one of the shifts that, the primary shift I think that we make when we practice something like mindfulness is very much a perspectival shift. A perspectival shift of how we view experience. And, you know, the thing about it, that's a little bit, not to go too matrix analogy on us, but, you know, by the time we start practicing mindfulness, I'm very fortunate and very grateful that I learned practice of mindfulness at the age of 18. But I had 18 years of really bad training under my belt. And then we start practicing mindfulness and we're offered this unbelievably radical perspective on experience. But what comes with that, it's not like we come into this blank slate moment. We wake up, we have all this conditioning, we have language that we've learned, we have words, we have meaning. We've inherited all of this stuff, you know, that's kind of preloaded. It's all front-loaded. And then we start practicing mindfulness, and we're trying to pay attention to experience in a way that's completely different than any other way that we've been taught. And for a lot of people, we get a lot of relief from that. For me, it was, oh my God. You know, when I was 18 years old, I lived in a highly traumatized mind. I had no trust for anything in the world at all whatsoever. I thought the world was just full of lies and foolishness, and nobody had any clue of what was really going on. It felt like a completely unsafe place. I lived in a world that I had constructed or had been constructed to me that I just thought I was trapped in. And I didn't. I looked towards the future, and I saw nothing that was even remotely interesting to me whatsoever. Thankfully for myself, I wasn't suicidal, but I was definitely not impressed with anything, except for I was pretty impressed with drugs at the time. Thank God for drugs. I would have never made it out. And then, you know, I get introduced to mindfulness, like, at the age of 18, and I have this massive radical shift in perspective that, like, I'm starting to see, like, oh, wait a minute, like I live in this constructed mind. I'm living in the matrix, basically. And then someone offers me, like, an escape door and says, yeah, you can get out at any time. You know? You can just connect with your breath. You can go for a walk in the woods. Like, and that's why I emphasized it that first day. I got introduced to that idea of the rocking back and forth. There was a conceptual experience that I lived in that was basically hell on earth. And then it was like this direct experience of breathing in my body. And in this direct experience, I was actually okay. Like, when I sat down and I felt into my body and I think I'm okay. My mind is telling me, definitely not okay. But my experience, my direct experience, is giving me a whole range of different information that I did not have access to. I'm fitting, I'm breathing, I feel well, I'm not sick. You know, there's actually in pleasure around, there's food to eat, there's a lot of stuff in the present moment experience that's actually, you know, good, and I feel okay, and I feel at ease. And then, so then I could see, oh, there was like this big splitting off. And that was like, probably some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. And usually at some point in your practice, early on in your practice, you kind of get this. I got a huge dose of it. And we get this, oh, okay, there's another way to be. Right? There's another way to navigate the world that's truly easeful and interesting and slow. And like that for many people, if that's all you get out of the practice, like aces, right? That's unbelievable. But I know that like myself and like many of you, we take it for granted, don't we? Right? We want more from the mindfulness. Right? And so that shift in that perspective, really, you know, waking up basically, right? That's what the Buddha said. I woke up. I woke up from something to something. Right? And we kind of rock back and forth between these two worlds. And this present world experience is really kind of where mindfulness is asking us to go, to stand near. That's another way, Satipatthana, to stand near the present moment experience, to be in the life that you're living and to be in the experience that you're having, rather than imagining the experience you could be having or that you should be having, if only things for me had gone otherwise. And it's so easy, isn't it? It's like that's like the career of our suffering begins when we want the experience to be different or otherwise. It shouldn't be like this, it should be like that. And how hard is it, right? Let's be honest. How hard is it to imagine a moment better than the one that you're in? Right there. And then we go into that and you know, there's all that suffering and confusion and uncertainty. And we do. We split off. We disconnect from the direct experience. And we become disintegrated. We become kind of like two realities in competition with each other. And we get this strong sense of there being an internal conflict. Right? You know, in philosophical terms, this is like, this is what being a human being is. It's like just one internal conflict after another. But the Buddha, unlike all other religious systems, and really unlike all other philosophical systems, and many philosophical systems I love and appreciate and study, and even other religious systems I find value and appreciation, but the Buddha is the only one who tells you that you can do something with the thing. The mind can be trained. He's the only person who kind of sniffed that one out. Not only can you train the mind, but you kind of have to. You know, this word, it's actually an interesting word. You probably know monkey mind. Someone brought it up today. You probably heard of monkey mind. The good thing about that word is it comes from the Pali text, actually. It's copy. It's a fun word to say. Kapichitta. Kapichitta, monkey mind. The mind that's just chasing after pleasure and pushing away pain and all over the place, swinging from this, that, to the other thing. You know, a lot of us, we have this. The mind has this capacity, but it can be trained. And so the teachings of Satipatthana give us a kind of way of understanding the system, how it's organized, and how we can kind of train to foster and to influence the mind experience, to be more present and really to be more at ease. And I think that's where, in the greater context of mindfulness, one thing that is missing and tends to be missing is this metta that Chris did such a wonderful job unpacking last night. This sense of ease, this sense of well-being, well-wishing, goodwill. And when those two come together, this is where I think the awareness actually becomes mindfulness, is when there's that quality, that remembering to recognize the goodness, the goodwill, the inherent well-being that we have. And so when you look at the, usually, and I will talk about the foundations because I think there's value in that, but that usually gets more airtime. There's other stuff in the text, actually, that I think that's more important or more interesting, and that is in the definition. And the definition is basically how one should be mindful. And he offers four. So basically what he talks about is contemplating and abiding in certain qualities. So I want to talk about this word contemplate, because I think it's a better word than meditation, actually. You know, if you study religion or meditation kind of systems in an academic setting, they call them contemplative practices. The world offers a range of contemplative practices. And the word contemplate is in the Pali text, and Bhikkhu Anālaya points this out, and he really is using this word a lot: contemplation of the body, contemplation of feelings. The word is anupasati. Anupasati is the word that he translates as contemplate, and it has some interesting meanings. It means, on one level, it means to stand near. It also means to repeatedly look at. Right? So, like, that's why we have to come back to the breath. When you're repeatedly looking at something, you're reflecting upon it, you're standing near it, you're contemplating that experience. Not to come to some particular outcome, but just for the sake of what you want to do, is you want to familiarize yourself with that experience. The Dalai Lama, actually, his definition of meditation is to familiarize yourself with dimensions of your experience. And, of course, ultimately to familiarize yourself with all the dimensions of your experience. Familiarity. And this reason why this contemplation, actually in Gestalt therapy, they have a great understanding of how this works, where we talk about making contact in the present moment experience. So we make contact with the breath, we make contact with sounds, we make contact with our direct experience. And contact, if you make contact over a period of time, that creates a sense of connection, which is really what we're trying to foster here. Feeling connected to our bodies, feeling connected to our hearts, feeling connected to the land, feeling connected to anything that you can feel connected to, because feeling disconnected is not good. And most of us are very familiar with the feeling of being disconnected. So when we make contact over a period of time, that creates a sense of connection. And you've been doing it for thousands of moments since you've been here. And you actually might notice that you feel a bit more connected to your experience. And you probably maybe even notice that that feels good. And that connection over time creates a sense of intimacy, of familiarity. And once there's a sense of connection and a sense of intimacy, the mind is less likely, and actually to some degree unwilling, to disconnect. Because there's a sense of courage, and there's a sense of enthusiasm, and there's a sense of, you know what, it's better here. There's an intimacy, there's a familiarity. And what makes that so hard is that a lot of times when we feel connected and we do have a sense of intimacy with our experience, we touch into and we wake up to experiences that are painful, that we don't want to feel. And what do? We disconnect. And it just literally doesn't work. You're just postponing the inevitable. It's like cheating at solitaire. Who are you cheating? You know what I mean? You know, this game solitaire, cheating at solitaire is ridiculous. But this is what we do. We're like, no. I'm fine. Yeah, right. So, you know, we start to see that. And then we build a capacity for that. We build a sense of resilience for that. And then that intimacy actually leads into relationships. So you have contact, connection, intimacy, and relationship. And this, of course, is what the Brahma-Viharas are all about, which I'll talk about this later, but I think is the highest of all Buddhist teachings, frankly. This way of relating to experience whether it's painful, whether it's pleasant, whatever, relating to it in a way that allows us to stay connected to that experience, regardless of what that experience is. Like, that is advanced skills as a human being. To stay connected no matter how much it hurts. Because actually, let's be honest, you can't really disconnect anyway. Right? You can't actually pull it off. Right? Try like hell, don't you? I do. I tried. I should have a PhD in learning how to disconnect from my experience. I've never been able to pull it off. And it comes with tremendous consequence. It's the cheating in solitaire. And so this contemplation, so then this abiding, this dwelling, which is also the word for Brahma-vihara. Vihara means to dwell. So you see the word dwelling in the Brahma-viharas, you see this word abiding in the mindfulness teachings. You see a lot of similarities between these things. You know, we come to abide, we become to dwell. And the one reason, this always makes me laugh, but I always love a good cultural reference. But every time I hear the word abide, I always think of Jeffrey Lebowski from The Big Lebowski. You know this movie? The Dude Abides. Now, I think we want to be a little more skillful than Jeffrey Lebowski, but he was definitely onto something. You know, the dude abides. He's just like this ability. And abiding and attaining are actually synonyms. So a lot of times we can, this is actually, I think, important, is you probably are doing this a lot, so let's just see if I can put words to it. Is that feeling of like being on the retreat and being like wanting to be on the retreat more? Like wanting to have something that you don't have now. Like, but when you're abiding, you are attaining. There's no difference. Here's sort of the bad news. There's nothing, you're not going to get anything. There's nothing to get. Right? So as soon as you go into the getting mode, you see now you've disconnected. I know it's irritating, I'm sorry. You know, it's like, what are you going to get? You know, you don't go for a walk. You don't even have lunch. When did you have lunch? At what moment did you have the lunch? This is one thing that's so wonderful about the Dharma. You actually can't ever have anything. Right? It's just this being mode. That's really what the Buddha's talking about. He's waking up to this being mode. Sort of having this and getting that and needing this. And it's this quality of being. Human beings. Right? And then he talks about these four qualities that, you know, really kind of speak to the dimension and the complexity of really like, this is like really not easy to do. And he uses these words, he uses the word diligent, direct knowing, mindful and awareness, and free from desire and discontent in regards to the world. So I just want to kind of, because these are actually in the definition, so he's defining this is how it's done. And the word diligent sometimes is a little bit misleading, but really what he's talking about is carefully attending. So there's a way of like we're practicing. Sometimes the word they use is ardency, but I don't like that word because I never use that word. Ardency has a sense of enthusiasm to it. It also really, for me, it's a sense of sincerity. It's like, I'm going to show up for myself. You know, it's the way we practice with some degree of sincerity rather than that like, you know, I'll catch myself kind of cheating at solitaire. I'm like, I'm mostly here. I'm mostly with my breath. You know, I'm kind of watching the present moment from the sideline as I'm like scrolling through the past and the future over here. You know, you probably did a little bit of this today. You know, I'm going to plan my retreat next summer. It's like, that's always a weird thing to do on retreat, planning your next retreat. Like, I'm going to do this again. I wonder when the schedule comes out for 2020. It's ridiculous, isn't it? I'm going to plan on doing the thing I'm already doing that I'm not really doing. And then this other word I think is really important is actually sometimes I think not described so well. It's called sampajano. It's a very important term. Sampajano usually sometimes is translated as clear knowing, but it's not so much it's clear knowing. Sampajano is about direct knowing. And so direct knowing is knowing the experience directly, which means that you're knowing it as it's occurring, which is actually where we get this idea of present moment. There's actually no term in the Pali text. This idea of a present moment is a very, we kind of made that up. There is really, the Buddha doesn't speak of there being a present moment in which one should be in. But it's just knowing directly. It's like knowing the sound of the bird right now. It's that knowing the in-breath right now. It's knowing things directly. And that's really what we're trying to foster, is this, like, this kind of direct knowing. And that direct knowing does keep us away from the kind of internal time traveling. And then, of course, they use the definition, for the definition, is with awareness or continuity of mindfulness, which is always trying to point us to this, like, you know, short moments many times. And that's really kind of what you're happening. That's kind of the progression of the days, is that, you know, short moments repeated become continuous. So it's like, you know, you're here for 7 seconds and you're gone for 28, and, you know, the numbers get better as you're here for longer. And then before you know it, you might do a whole 30-minute sit where you're like, I was mostly directly connected the whole time. You have to train for that. That's going to come with time. But that's that kind of direct knowing that we want to get. And that awareness, that continuity of mindfulness. And then this one, I could talk for a whole hour on this, but I won't, because it's so important, is the fourth definition is to put aside our desires and discontents in regards to the world. How many times have you been visited by the world today? Right? And it's interesting choice of words. He doesn't say abandon, he doesn't say get rid of. He says put aside. So when you're on this retreat, which is why we kind of name it at the beginning, is we're just asking you to just put that aside for now. Because I don't know about you, but I look at the world, we all live in this world, I have so many desires, so many things I want from the world, so many things I don't want for the world. Like that if you don't put these aside, then you're just going to be swimming in the fears and the cravings and the hopes and the what-ifs. That it's interesting that he says, and the word he uses is loka, which isn't the... So we have this kind of two-world situation. We have the world of direct experience that we're trying to cultivate here. And then we have this word, the world, loka, that which is really out there, the world of society, of politics, of geography, of locations, you know, the world, right? But we're really trying to develop this internal world and trying to have this turning ourselves inward and coming into that. And the only way we can really do that is to put this aside. It doesn't mean that we're cold. It doesn't mean that we don't care. It just means that we're going to put that aside. And so, like, when I practice meditation at home, one of the things I always remind myself before I sit down is, like, okay, it's like giving yourself a break. You know, you just can't be thinking about the world all the time. It's just totally exhausting. So that's in his definition. And I think it's interesting that he put that in there, because the world that he lived in was definitely not as complex and advanced as the world that we live in. I mean, what was really going on in, you know, 5th century BC India? Probably not a whole lot of stuff. But yet, he had the foresight and he had the awareness to say, yeah, like, if you're going to practice this, you're going to have to put that aside. You know, somebody stole my horse. You know, probably like the big headline of the day. You know, but for us, I think it's interesting that some of his teachings are more relevant now than when he came up with them. I think a lot of them fall into that category. So maybe he saw where this was all headed, was trying to help us. And so then there's also a refrain in the texts. And a refrain is kind of like the chorus of a song. You know, it kind of comes around, and the refrain comes around after every single time. And the refrain instructions are very interesting. The first one is to understand, like, so the body, understanding the body internally, understanding the body externally, and understanding both internally and externally, which is a kind of clever way to say that we really want to be connected to the external experience. You know, so like the breath is a great venue for that, because we breathe in the external oxygen, the body does something with it, processes it, and breathes out the carbon dioxide, and that's kind of happening. So there's a way we can do that with the body, with the feelings, with all of these experiences. And the next one, I think, is one that points to the reality, which is kind of core Buddhist theory. So I don't know if it's a theory as much as it's just reality, which is impermanence, that things are constantly in flux. And to monitor arising and passing away. So noticing things arise, and then they pass away. And what that does is that helps us let go, you know. That kind of understanding impermanence. And there's one more piece in there that comes in later Buddhist thought that I think is important to name, is that there is arising and passing away, but there's also this third thing called duration. So something arises in the mind experience, how long does it stay for? Right? Some stuff stays for a long time. Why? Because we don't want it to fade away. And then the next instruction points to that, because he says, we do this practice internally, externally, both internally and externally, seeing arising and passing away, not clinging to anything in this world, not clinging to the desires and the discontents. Right? And so part of that is to see that, you know, certain things come up, we hold on to them, we grab onto them, and we want to train ourselves to allow these things to kind of come and go. So let's just talk a little bit about these tanas, I like to call them the tanas, the foundations, the ground. Where can we ground the mind? And where most people try to ground the mind is in thinking. Door number six. What's behind door number six?
Everything.
Right? Everything's behind door number six. And I would argue most people live, and that's where most people just live. They're just caught up in the world of the mind to the point where they're caught up in the world of the mind that they don't even know that there's this other experience right under your nose 24/7. And so we get that because we see that rocking back and forth. And he starts with, of course, the body. So they're not like they're progressions. It's not like we do them in stages, but he's just trying to bring us into the most basic aspects of experience, and then they kind of expand out a little bit. And of course, as you go from the first foundation to the fourth, they become more subtle, they become more nuanced, they become less like obvious material. Like, you know, can you put your attention on the sensations of the in-breath? Like, you can do that immediately. That's a very easy task to perform. Right? So he's clever. He's helping us out. He's saying, I'll give you something real easy to do. But can you connect with a feeling of kindness for yourself? Yeah, that's a little harder to locate. But you, in time, that can be as obvious as the sensation of the in-breath. And so, you know, even right in the sutta, he says, you know, the meditator goes to a forest, goes to an empty hut or sits at the foot of a tree, sits down cross-legged with the body erect, breathing in, one knows I'm breathing in. Breathing out, one knows that I'm breathing out. Right? Breathing in long, one knows I'm breathing in long. Breathing out long, one knows I'm breathing out long. And so there's that knowing, it's that connecting and that sustaining. It's like not just, I know that I'm breathing, but it's actually sustaining attention through the full cycle of the in-breath and the out-breath. Right? That's actually not so easy to do. Right? But that's where we're trying to get trained. He's trying to bring us into something that we're missing. And so we have, it's not just the body, it's the body, it's the temperature on the skin, it's the weight of the body in the chair, it's the bones, it's the nervous system, it's the respiratory system. The person who I give most credit for teasing this out in a very broad way would be Peter Levine, who has the somatic experience, a trauma therapy, where he really speaks about the body in very, very elaborate ways so that we can understand, you know, the nervous system and the respiratory system, and that we can actually, a lot of healing can be done just through relating to the body in a different way. Because when we become dysregulated, that's a body thing. That's a nervous system thing. And so just being on the land here, just like, it's just regulating for your nervous system. I'll give you a little forerunner for tomorrow, because tomorrow's day three, I believe. There's an Aboriginal theory that Mark Coleman turned me on to that I really like and I think is true. And he says in the Aboriginal in Africa, they say that the modern world is 3 days deep. And what that means, 3 days deep, is that it means it takes three full days to be out of that world into an environment like this to basically be like kind of normal again. So in many ways, I have a very strong background in addiction. It's like, and you might be feeling it, there's a little bit of a detox that we go through. Like, I don't know about you, but yesterday, like when we were done at 8:10 last night, I was toast. I went to bed, I was like, oh, like I haven't even like been practicing all day. I'm totally fried. Why am I so tired? Because you don't have any like dopamine stimulation. No refrigerator, no phone, no tea. It's just, all your dopamine, you know, little like the rat tapping on the thing has been removed, and you're just like totally depleted. You know, and know what they say, dopamine is dumb. So, you know, like don't let that bum you out. That's like really common. And so, like, you might even notice at the end of the day tomorrow, you'll start to kind of feel like you're waking up a little bit more. You kind of feel more tuned into the environment. Right? So it takes a while. But 3 days, not too bad, actually, in the grand scheme of things. And so there's a lot of, I can keep talking about it, but I'll move on. It's like there's a lot of teachings and emphasis on being, and we use this word embodied, somebody who's embodied, in touch with the somatic experience. Right? And then they get a little bit more complicated. And the next one is mindfulness or contemplation of feeling. Feeling not meaning emotion at all. The Pali word vedana is really about the impression that's created by sense experience. So all senses, all six senses, have a feeling tone, meaning that like everything has a tonality of being pleasant or unpleasant or somewhere in the middle, which really makes it really complicated. And so there's also this one thing this also indicates to this word contact I kind of mentioned, which we mention a lot in meditation. When we make contact with the present moment experience, the Pali word is paso, which means contact, but actually literally means to be touched. So when we touch the present moment experience, it touches us back. So we touch and we're touched by. It's what they call affect in the clinical world. We're affected, like we're affected by everything. It's all this affect coming in through all six doors all the time, which can be tiring. Right? So we're highly sensitive. So this Vedana experience, we make contact. And if we make contact with things that are painful, that's really hard to negotiate. Of course, as an organism for survival, when we come into contact with something that's painful, of course we want to disconnect from it. We're actually wired to disconnect from that. But, you know, we're not living on we're not on the Serengeti plain anymore. Nobody's going to be eaten by a tiger tomorrow. So we disconnect from things that are actually not really that. We become so trained ourselves to disconnect, we don't even know what we're disconnecting from or why. And then we start to see, oh, actually, I actually can connect with this quite a bit, it turns out. And so Vedana is really kind of the pleasure-pain dichotomy, which is really, sometimes they talk about it as pleasant, painful, and neutral, which is kind of a good teaching apparatus, but it's too limited because it kind of only gives you three categories. In reality, in the early discourses, it's really pleasure, pain, and then everything in the middle, which is like a huge range. And so what we have is kind of this indifferent area, you know. So we want to, or I would actually use the word ordinary. And there's actually a really good theory here, I think, that's really helpful, is that with mindfulness, when we're tuned into the ordinary or to the neutral, that becomes pleasant. That becomes like deeply content, at ease, a lot of things. But if there's ordinary neutrality experience going on and there's not mindfulness, it becomes unpleasant. We get bored, we become apathetic, we get meh. Not that great here, really, is it the woods, you know? My mind does this. My mind likes to ruin things. I'll tell you this funny story that happened a couple years ago. I was on retreat here. And it was like day five, and I was kind of like over being on retreat. You know, I was like, I wanted to go get some pizza or something, you know, or watch something. I was like, okay, enough is enough. And I was sitting on the porch, and I was like, it's nice, but like, whatever, it's just the woods. My mind is complaining, mind is just ruling me. And I see this blue herring flying through the sky. And as I'm having this complaint session, the blue herring swoops down into the pond, grabs this like big fish in its mouth, flies through the sky to the tree across there, and sits up there and just eats this fish. Like, I'm watching the blue heron, like, tear this fish apart from the tree, like, eating it. And I was like, okay, I'll shut up now. I was like, I'm not big on signs, but point well taken. Like, you never would see that. It was like, if it was a nature show, the guy in the camera would have been stoked. You know, it was like totally one of those things. And everybody else was walking around, and I couldn't talk. I was like, Everybody else is walking around being like, this sucks, man. With some carbs, some sugar. I'm like, there's a bird eating a fish in a tree. Nobody else saw it. I was kind of, my little moment. Actually, weirdly enough, it totally changed my attitude for the rest of the day. You know this mind, I don't know if you have it, I have an addiction background, so like I have a really strong complaining mind, which can really ruin the present moment like really fast and in very convincing ways. So if you have that, my hat goes off to you. It's rough. I haven't made a whole lot of progress. So this is this feeling tone, so we can just kind of notice the pleasant, unpleasant nature of it. Of course, we notice when it's unpleasant, when the mood is unpleasant, we don't like it. And this is like really one of the transformational parts of practice, is we're really trying to transform the reality of this. Right? So that we can be connected with painful experiences, and it's okay. That's where that metta is so crucial. It's like, okay, I'm allowed to suffer here. I'm allowed to have, this is allowed to be here, which is really what the dimension of metta is. It allows our humanity to flourish, even if we don't want it to be like this. And for many people, that's really the big game changer, is the way we relate to feelings that are difficult to be with. And again, they get more complicated. The other thing to just add to this, to get the dimensions of how rich the feeling is that they're also categorized into what are called worldly feelings and unworldly feelings. And worldly feelings are kind of hedonic, you know, like the pleasure of a good meal or the enjoyment of watching TV and all that stuff, which is actually all fine and good. We have to be careful as Buddhists, we don't start getting weird about that. If you enjoy things in the world, it's actually okay. Right? Let's be clear about that. But so there's worldly, there's hedonic pleasure, the world of senses, the pleasantries of the flesh, or pain of that. But then there's these unworldly pleasant feelings, something like kindness, gratitude, joy, that we actually have a lot of. What also came with the equipment is all these internal feelings that are totally pleasant and enjoyable, that are unworldly, that they can arise. They don't need to have an external trigger to arise. You can just be like sitting in the field at ease, content, just sitting there enjoying the moment for the sake of enjoying the moment without needing it to come from some external source, which is really kind of really what Dharma practice is all about, is to dwell and to abide in these unworldly, immaterial feelings. Okay, of well-being, of contentment, of ease. You know, if you look in the Buddhist discourse, there's like a huge taxonomy of these terms, of these immaterial, unworldly feelings that we can cultivate and that we can access. Right? And so we don't have to be, and we want to, as non-monastic people, we actually want to be able to do both. We want to be able to enjoy going out with friends to see a movie and have a meal, and be able to just kind of sit and do nothing. We want to be able to do both, which actually makes it a lot more complicated for people who don't live in a monastery, which it looks like it's all of you. So again, I think we have to be careful that we don't demonize the pleasure that we get from the world, which is easy to do as a Buddhist. I've done it. It's totally unpleasant. Don't do it. You know, that idea that wanting things is sort of bad and wrong. We can get this message right that I shouldn't want anything. And that's not really so good. So we have to have a middle way between these things. You know, and again, they get a little bit more complicated. The JD did a really good job of setting me up yesterday for this talk. Thank you. And talking about this word chitta, this is the third foundation of mindfulness, which is a hard word to translate, but in the context of mindfulness, it's sort of the mental state, the way that I experience it is the attitude of the mind. What is the attitude of the mind? And it's like, for me, it's like kind of like filters. Like if I... Let's just say I don't get a lot of sleep and I didn't sleep good and I'm kind of tired and I went to bed too late and I woke up too early and I get out of my bedroom in my house and I put on my like aversive grumpy Dave glasses. Like I walk out into my living room and like everything's wrong. Like the kitchen's the wrong color. The kids didn't put their shoes away again. Why is the dog on the couch? The dog should be in the crate. It's just totally like I'm just projecting this quality of mind onto everything. But I don't realize, I should probably take off my grumpy aversive glasses. Right? So it's kind of a filter, is how we filter experience through. Now, on the other side of the coin, if I went to bed early and I got enough sleep and I wake up feeling good, I can walk into the same kitchen and have the same mess and the same dog and the same thing that didn't get put away and totally be at ease. So the thing what we have to do that's so hard is learning how to take responsibility for our mental states rather than projecting that state onto reality. Right. So we want to kind of get a sense of that. And that's a little bit more complicated than like monitoring the rise and fall of the in and out breath. That's a little bit more challenging. And it's a little bit more challenging because the Buddha is just uncompromising, like, ongoing pointing out, like, you are responsible for your experience. You know, you are responsible. You know, and it's really hard sometimes to take responsibility. Because I'm like, well, some of this stuff has got to be somebody else's fault. Like, come on. You know? Like, is it really all mine? You know, and it's like, well, even if I have decided, even if we follow that logic out, it doesn't do me any good anyway. Even if I've decided I'm in a bad mood because of your behavior and you need to be different, that helps zero people, including me. So again, you're cheating in solitaire again. You're just like, you know. So we want to be able to notice the presence and the absence of these qualities of mind. You know, and the Buddha talks about sort of greed, hatred, and confusion. Is there wanting or not wanting in the mind? Is there, you know, aversion in the mind? And to me, aversion, this kind of quality of not wanting or ill will, has a big spectrum. But I always bow down to the power of aversion to just literally sneak into any moment and go, shouldn't be like this. It's just, it's unbelievable to me how sneaky it is. And I like to think as a Buddhist teacher, I'm like, yeah, when aversion arises in my mind, I immediately recognize it and I abandon it completely. No way. Sometimes I like it. I'm like, oh yeah, what else is wrong? Oh, yeah. It's a lot of stuff wrong right now. And it's like, I'm going to make a list. My wife wakes up, we're going to be talking about this list. I'm sure she's got a list too. It's going to be a busy morning at the Smith House. Like, to sit down and talk about everything that's wrong. Right? And it's just like, you know, it's funny. It's funny now. Right? But what's going on is there's just aversion in my mind. You know? So he's even saying, like, to notice, and even as the text says, to notice, and he used the word anger or ill will, but, like, aversion is the better word, I think, because it's a little bit, doesn't have that charge. One knows when I have aversion in my mind. I know I have aversion in my mind. Or I know I don't have aversion in my mind. Right? One knows that we have these qualities. And this is really, I think, where the Buddhist kind of liberation ideas become so poignant or so kind of very practical, because you can liberate yourself from these destructive mental states, like, immediately, you know? You ever been in, like, you can kind of change your attitude if you want to. It's actually not that hard. A, you have to recognize that the attitude's there. You have to do a little bit of work. But usually it's, like, not that hard to shift. And sometimes other things can help shift that. And that's really what we're trying to cultivate. Chris will talk about this in days to come. Really trying to cultivate this, you know, trying to cultivate the wholesome side of the mind and trying to abandon and to let go of the unwholesome side of the mind. And one of the reasons why I think mindfulness has become so popular, thanks to many people in the early 70s, you know, people from the Buddhist tradition, Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, you know, all these, we know and love these people who brought these practices over. But then there's a whole side of people from the science world who were sitting in the same retreats with these folks. Richard Davidson, Daniel Goleman, Mirabai Bush, who like really went down the science road. And really what they started to recognize is they're studying clinical psychology in the early 70s, and they're just kind of like, wow, like, the West is just totally obsessed with all of, like, the bad side of the mind. Like, mental diagnoses and the pathologization of the mental experience is kind of the way we view psychology in the West. We're, like, obsessed with the negativity. And then they learn these Buddhist meditations, and Dan Goleman talks about reading the Visuddhimagga and being like, well, Buddhism is actually the entire opposite of that. The Buddhism is actually interested in the upside of the mind. Not what are the causes of all these pathologies, but what are the causes of well-being? what are the causes of happiness? How do we foster and develop that? And so it's like kind of a completely, they're diametrically opposed. And they were so excited about it. Of course, they've been 50 years later, they're still kind of fighting that war, like trying to really bring this stuff into the marketplace, which is mostly a good thing. So then we get to see like that, you know, there's an empowering piece to that of like, you can do it. You know, we really can. And, you know, it takes a while, you know. It's not fast. I always tell people when I start working with them, if you're looking for fast and quick and easy, I'm not your guy. This is the wrong practice for you. This is the slow, long road. But as the Buddha says many times, the Dharma is good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, it's good in the end. Because, you know, as soon as you get that, right, and you've all had it, there's no way if you all understand what I'm talking about, or you would not be sitting in this room right now. You don't just kind of like slip on a banana peel and end up in the lodge at Vallecitos. You know, you've done some hard thinking and some planning and made some sacrifices, right? It's like not easy to come on retreat, you know, but you obviously, something in your life has occurred where you're like, okay, like I value this enough. This makes at least enough of sense to me. I'm being offered. This is the one thing that really, I think JD and I both connect over, that makes me trust this so much, is I finally was offered a framework that actually made sense to me. You know, that I could actually get behind and go, okay, what they're saying, this actually, I can understand how this might work. And when we are offered a frame, a practice frame, a contemplative frame, that actually makes sense, then our ability to practice with that sincerity is much stronger. Like if I'm not totally bought in, if I'm like, I don't know, Dharma, man, there's a lot of stuff out there. Maybe I just need to get some gummies and some powder, so get some cachava, you know? But when we're offered something that has that depth and weight to us and has that transformational quality, that even if we get a little taste of it, you know, the Buddha says that, right? The Dharma just has the salt, just as the ocean has one taste, the taste of salt, the Dharma has one taste, the taste of freedom. We get that little taste, right? However small it might be, it really allows us to kind of go, okay, there's actually something here that has depth and weight. And then we can start to see, like, okay, this is a way of practicing in the world that can be done, that's sustainable. And so the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the fourth tana, Chris will unpack this more in days to come, but I'll just kind of give it a little bit of a highlight and hopefully tee him up in a way that's going to be helpful to him. It's really complicated, actually, but it doesn't have to be. and it is really like, it's where we start to deal with things like mental habits and thinking, and what we're really trying to do is cultivate mindfulness. We're trying to wake up. We're trying to actually recognize and cultivate qualities of mind that are wholesome, that are constructive, that are skillful, that are adaptive, all these words. And of course, the first one is mindfulness. You know, so this is why I think mindfulness is so predominant. It has become, when you look at the entire teachings of the Buddhist tradition, the one that's kind of made its way into modernity is mindfulness, I think, because it's really, it sits at the bottom of the whole enterprise, you know. With mindfulness, we can wake up, we can recognize, you know, aspects of our psychological, behavioral, emotional system that don't serve us. So again, we have to be careful. It's not about getting rid of the bad stuff and getting the good stuff. It's not so much that black and white of like, there's stuff that are bad that needs to go and there's stuff that's good. There's just stuff that leads to well-being. In a clinical sense, there's functions and aspects of mind that are highly adaptive. They're helpful. And dysfunctions of mind that are not so much. And that's really kind of what you're learning here. And you're getting a full force PhD in this stuff. You know, and so as these days go on and as you learn, you can kind of practice in this way.